It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Outdoor activities like hunting and fishing have long been dominated by men, but a Wisconsin-based program provides opportunities for women to get started with the help of other women. The director of the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program joins us now to talk about what the program offers, share some of its history, and how you can get involved. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a woman who loves the outdoors? How did you get started? What got you into it? Were there family members who trained you, or did you find it yourself? Have you been involved in this program yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Peggy Farrell is the director of the International Becoming an Outdoors Woman program based out of the College of Natural Resources at UW-Stevens Point. She's the coordinator of workshops held in Wisconsin. Peggy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, happy to be here.
What are the goals of the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program?
Well, the mission is to break down barriers to participation of women in outdoor activities. So that's the simple statement. I think our goals are to create a safe, welcoming, empowering environment for women to maybe step outside their comfort zone a little to learn these new activities.
Tell us a little bit about the origin of becoming an outdoors woman.
Sure. It started in 1991 as a result of a conference that was held at UWSP to look at what are those barriers to women to participate in the outdoors. And a lot of the barriers seem to point toward a lack of educational opportunities. So if there wasn't a place for women to go and learn, then it was decided that we would build one. So the very first bow program was held at Tree Haven Field Station in 1991. And after that, other states started to hear about this cool thing that we were doing in Wisconsin and called and said, how can we do it too? Now we're in 35 states and 7 Canadian provinces.
Now let's talk about one of the, well, you do a lot of different programs. Let's talk about something you might do here in Wisconsin. When a woman signs up and participates, what kind of activities are involved?
Anything you can do in the outdoors. So in general, we try to keep balanced programming with one third hunting and shooting, one third fishing and boating, and then that other third can be bird watching, wildlife photography, hiking, canoeing, camping, kayaking. And that means that there's something for everyone because not everybody wants to sit in a kayak and not everybody wants to go out fishing. So we try to do a little bit of a lot of different things to create opportunities for everyone out there.
Now, a key part of the program, as I understand it, Peggy, is that it's women participating in classes taught by other women. Why is that such a central part of BOW?
I think having a somebody to look up to, a peer who is doing things that you might think are challenging, but you see somebody else doing them and understand that you can too with the right guidance is really important. So we do have mainly women instructors, but we have quite a few men instructors too who are just excellent because of their patience and their familiarity with the program and their understanding of our approach to teaching in an inclusive and a safe and a non-competitive atmosphere.
Peggy Farrell is with us, director of the International Becoming an Outdoors Woman program based at UW-Stevens Point, talking about their programs and efforts to get women involved in, as we heard, a wide variety of outdoor activities. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Whether you've done it with this program or not, are you a woman who is involved in hunting, fishing, hiking, and other outdoor activities? Did it ever feel like there were barriers to you as a woman to get into different types of outdoor stuff? Have you joined in as an instructor or a participant in the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program? Join in now at 800-642-1234 with your experiences. Maybe your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peggy, men, women, anyone. I've been talking to people lately saying we're seeing fewer people getting into hunting in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country, getting into fishing, often because they didn't grow up with that. Can you talk about some of the barriers for anyone that might keep them from giving it a try, even if they are interested?
Sure. It can be hard to find a place to go to learn if you didn't grow up learning. For example, we do some special programming for the college students here at the university, because even though we've got the College of Natural Resources, which is well respected throughout the nation, not everybody who comes here as a student has that background of hunting and fishing. And it can be a little intimidating when you're surrounded by a majority of people who might have been doing those activities since they were really little. So we offer Learn to Hunt programs for the college students, and we have both male and female participants in that as a way of removing that barrier, again, of don't have a place to go to learn. So we make the place for them to learn, and sometimes they keep going with it long enough that they come back and help us out with instructing.
And can you talk about, you know, whenever I learn anything new outdoors or otherwise, you know, I'm worried about looking dumb as I learn it, ask the stupid question, that kind of thing. How do you help establish that comfort level for somebody who might be, whatever, kayaking or fishing or you name it for the first time ever?
Yes, that's. I think that's true for all of us. I still have it. You know,
it's good to hear.
Nobody likes to look quote unquote stupid, but you know, we start out all of our classes right away by saying, you know, no stupid questions. If you've got this question in your mind, there's a good chance that one or more people in the class have the same question too, so don't be afraid to ask. Sometimes we'll put out a little anonymous question box for when we take a break from classes, so that if somebody's really afraid to ask, they can put their questions in there. And the way we help people not feel like they look stupid is by setting them up for success. So if it's in a canoe class, we make sure everybody can learn how to get in and out of that boat without tipping over, and we're right there supervising it all. So there are always little things that you can do no matter what the activity is to set people up for success so that they don't feel silly. And if something goes wrong, like they swamp a boat, you know, we figure out ways to make the best of that, too. Safety is always first and foremost, but we can also recover from little mistakes and still keep our chin up.
Now, a lot of the things you might associate with the outdoors might be warm weather through hunting season. There's snow on the ground now. Do you have winter-specific programming here in Wisconsin, or do you kind of hibernate through the winter?
No. If we're going to live in Wisconsin, we need to know how to get out there and enjoy it. So we do a winter workshop in February at Treehaven Field Station, which is actually part of the university, but it's a campus up between Tomahawk and Rhinelander. 3-day weekend, participants get to choose from cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, ice fishing, archery. We do some indoor classes because not everybody wants to be outside the whole time, like woodworking and fur sewing, and we'll do knot tying. So more than 20 classes, they get to choose 4 of those to participate in throughout the weekend. And some people wouldn't call Tomahawk up north if you're from Wisconsin, but being
depends
a little,
on where you are, yeah.
Little further up north in that beautiful 1,400-acre property in the wintertime is breathtaking. We get people from all over the United States who come to that workshop. In particular, a lot of folks from southern states just think this sounds like a wonderful, fabulous adventure to participate in and then go home with bragging rights, because they might have like driven a truck across the ice, drilled a hole in the ice, pulled the fish out of the ice. So that's one of our most popular workshops.
We're talking to Peggy Farrell, director of the International Becoming an Outdoors Woman program based here in Wisconsin. Peggy also coordinates workshops held here in the state. And we're talking about what the program offers and how to participate. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an outdoors woman in one way or another? How did you get started? Have you been doing it since you were a kid, or is it something you tackled later on in life? Does participating in male-dominated outdoor activities, hunting, say, fishing, kayaking, ever feel intimidating? Maybe public radio listeners aren't big outdoors people. I don't think that's true, but well, you're not calling in. Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can join in with your experiences or your questions. You can also post, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Peggy Farrell, director of the International Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, or BOW, and coordinator of workshops held here in the state. She's talking with us about BOW, which offers the opportunity for women to learn outdoor skills, in many cases from other women. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're comfortable in the outdoors, how do you encourage beginners, first timers? Have you participated in this program yourself? Love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Hubertus. Daryl, hi.
Hi. Hi. I've gone to BOW 10 times. First time I was very nervous. Walked in, I thought, what am I doing? I'm not athletic. I'm not even coordinated. And I don't do any of this hunting and fishing. And I said, when somebody asked me, how are you? I said, I'm not sure why I'm here. And so one of the women said, this woman needs a hug. So that's how it started. I've never used a power tool. I made a bird feeder. I went ice fishing early with an auger, dug the hole. It was 24 degrees below zero, by the way, not wind chill that day.
Wow.
Dog sledding, sewing with fur. It's just lots of things. Archery. My husband said, why are you taking all this stuff? I said, well, because I probably not could ever do any of it. I got to see what I'm missing.
Daryl, I have so many questions. First of all, since you had clearly some nervousness on that first day there, what got you to try it out in the first place?
I saw it in a Wisconsin National Field magazine that I get. And I thought, oh, just a little article. And I read it, and I thought, oh, well, I used to like walking around the woods when I was a little kid with my dad and stuff, but they hunted, I didn't. And I thought, well, I think I'll go. And none of my friends wanted to go, so I went.
And have you, any of those activities, are there things you do all the time on your own now, Daryl?
No, I do snowshoeing.
Oh.
I've got pretty bad arthritis right now, so that's about the best one I can keep up on. I love to wear my hat and my mittens that are just fabulous that I sewed with fur. I have fooled around with making soap.
Wow.
If we were still tent camping, but we're way beyond that, I love the cooking, outdoor cooking. But at this point, we aren't camping.
Gotcha. Daryl, thank you so much. Well, Peggy, a testimonial from somebody who had those last-minute nerves about it, but kept going back.
Oh, yeah, I recognize Daryl's voice. So nice to hear from you. And thank you for saying nice things about the program. I think, captured really well what it's like for a lot of people, where you're like, oh, what am I doing? What am I getting myself into? But in a very short amount of time, people just fit right in, start making new friends, feel at ease. And I say it's a little bit of voodoo magic when you put anywhere from like 50 to 100 women from all different walks of life, you know, different backgrounds, different ages, different education levels, ethnicities, all of that. Put them together for a whole weekend, and everybody just takes care of each other. It's something you really have to go experience to get it. But it's what makes me so lucky to have this position and to be able to meet all those great women like Daryl.
Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Jennifer now in Eagle River. Jennifer, hi.
Hello. I attended four different BOW workshops and hope to do so again, actually in preparation for moving from the city to the Northwoods of Wisconsin.
Oh.
So I would have a little Northwoods credibility. So I'm back in the city now, but thanks to BOW, I was able to embrace living in a very cold area and snowshoeing and doing some hunting and cross-country skiing and some ice fishing. And I became a Northwoods woman thanks to Bo teaching me how to be an outdoors woman. It's such a wonderful welcoming program, and the evening camaraderie activities are really nice too, in addition to the workshops. And Peggy Farrell is just the most amazing person. So everyone should take a Bo workshop.
Jennifer, thanks so much for sharing that experience. Now, Peggy, Jennifer was kind of prepping for a move to this from the city to the Northwoods. Do you get that a lot from people saying, you know, where I've lived or in my background, I haven't had a lot of this exposure, and they're kind of doing that boot camp to get ready to get involved in that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think Jennifer is the fourth person who's told me that they came to Bo because they were making that move from the city, either Milwaukee or Chicago area, to start a new part of a new chapter of their life up north, and they wanted to get some skills to be able to fit in. So I think that's really interesting, and thank you, Jennifer, for your call.
Thanks for that call, Jennifer. Rachel is with us now in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi.
I wouldn't call myself a full survival woman. I'm still working on my skills, but I initially got into it with historical reenactment, so lots of, like, knots and getting down and dirty and things like that. And there is a lot of intimidation for me, especially with the historical context of men and women and stuff like that. But when people bring up that they think they survived the longest in a zombie apocalypse, I do get quite defensive because I am proud of the skills that I do have.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that. I'd probably get on pretty fast in the zombie apocalypse. I'm not fooling myself. Rachel, thanks a lot for that, though. Down and dirty kind of survival-type skills, Peggy, is that not tying Rachel mentioned? Are those some of the skills people might pick up in Bo?
Yeah, we do a survival class in the fall in October, and then one specifically for winter. And those are always jam-packed, full classes. Lots of people want to learn those skills, some because it's a novelty, like to make a snow cave and see if you can make it outside the whole night in your cave, and others because they really seriously want to learn these skills in case they need to put them to good use. So yep, we do that stuff.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Peggy Farrell with the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program. It's international. It's based here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Started here in Wisconsin, for that matter. Amy is with us now in Iola. Amy, hello.
Hi. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you? It's so good to hear your voice. I ran in. Peggy was also, Becoming an Outdoors Woman was also a haven for me as I ventured into, surviving, going back to college as a non-traditional student. But I also, Peggy took me on as an instructor 1 year for teaching a little bit about upland game bird hunting and training bird dogs. So that was really, really fun. And I'm wondering if you still do that.
Oh, we do. Yes. And so I've got a big list of things on our website for a schedule of like over 17 different events. And Amy, you're always welcome back. So if you find you've got time and you want to run some dogs, let's do it.
Thanks for the call, Amy. Rachel joins us now in Lake Geneva. Rachel, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment that I actually work in the outdoor industry as an arborist, and we have seen plenty of females come through the company that I work for, and women make excellent tree climbers and learning knots and all sorts of different things, and the culture around it is just so supportive, and it's a great place to be immersed in the outdoors while also earning a living.
Rachel, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Peggy, I wonder if somebody like Amy with the bird dogs wanted to get involved as a teacher, or maybe somebody like Rachel as an arborist wanted to share her knowledge and skills with others. How do people get involved with Bo as instructors?
Yeah, we're always looking for new folks to come on board. So excited to hear from both of those ladies. I think the best way to get a hold of me is to call me in my office. And I can provide a number if you would like.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
715-346-4681.
And we'll also get a link to your website over at WPR.org/Central Time. Time for one more caller. Jason is with us in La Crosse. Jason, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jason?
Yeah, up here in La Crosse, they have the Sarah Hogan Foundation where they bring in law enforcement to take youth out and go fishing. Kind of neat. They get police officers, DNR officials, firefighters. They even get the Gunderson medevac to come in, and they get to see that too. So they go out and fish, and it's a great time.
Jason, thanks a lot for sharing that resource in the La Crosse area. And that reminds me of something I wanted to ask you, Peggy. Is Bo for grown-ups, or are there programs for girls as well?
Bo is for anyone 18 and older, and sometimes we do have male participants. Not often, but we don't discriminate. I wish we had more resources so that we could offer, you know, maybe family programs or moms and daughters or programs just for daughters. I have collaborated with other organizations that have served kids, younger kids, and I enjoy that. But right now, it's not on the docket for Wisconsin. Some of the other states offer Becoming an Outdoors Family programs that are really successful. We just need to get a little more people power and a little more in the finances to make that happen here.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Peggy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Peggy Farrell, director of the International Becoming an Outdoors Woman program based out of UW-Stevens Point and coordinator of bow workshops held here in Wisconsin. She talked to us about the types of workshops and trips offered through the bow program and how to get involved. You can find more info or share your own experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, we'll get a link to that organization and how to get involved at WPR.org/Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Wisconsin and around the U.S. have seen some substantial increases this month. In Wisconsin, COVID hospitalizations are up over 10%, on par with the country as a whole. At the same time, vaccination rates for the latest booster are staying low. Just about 1 in 5 Americans have gotten it. On top of that, it's the season for influenza and RSV, and some people are talking about strep as well. Our next guest is a public health expert here in Wisconsin with a look at the latest news in the multivirus season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten the latest COVID booster? Why? Why not? Have you caught the flu or COVID, or has RSV hit your family so far this year? Join in with your experiences, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon, Rob. Always a pleasure to join you.
Now, as I mentioned, we saw COVID hospitalizations go up some in the state. Milwaukee County, hospitalizations jumped, I believe, 50%. Now, these are coming up from low baselines. I don't want to come in with a panicked frame of mind here. Can you talk about what we're seeing in those hospitalization numbers, what we can read from that?
Well, I think last I checked, our average over a week was about 350 patients hospitalized, which is very, very low compared to where we were, for example, early on in the pandemic and during that Omicron surge. But we are seeing some acceleration out there. The good news that I can share is we're seeing less really sick people. About 10% of those hospitalized are in intensive care. But because of widespread use of vaccine, because of previous infection, we're seeing less of a overall effect.
One big question, and I've talked about to you about this over the last few years, Dr. Tempty, is COVID going to be a seasonal kind of virus with flare-ups in the way that, you know, influenza and colds and other things are? It's starting to look like that's the case. We're going to see it go up frequently in the fall. Does that seem to be the case?
Yeah, I'm going to abandon all cautiousness here and say absolutely COVID is going to become our fifth seasonal coronavirus. So this is something that we will see off and on, usually seasonally going forward. And part of that is going to depend on what variants we see coming around. But most of the respiratory viruses really prefer the cooler, drier seasonality that we get here in Wisconsin. So my prediction is really going to be an October through April or May virus.
You said fifth. Now, I think influenza is in the coronavirus family. I believe the common cold is, correct if I'm wrong. Fill out the count for me, please.
Yeah, there are other viruses that people don't usually think of. They have funny names like 229E, HKU1, NL63, and OC43. So those are the four other seasonal coronaviruses that have been in circulation for decades and that we in primary care see every year. But those act more like the common cold viruses, giving us sniffles, maybe a little fever, cough, and so on. And so we're going to see, I think, more of that going on. You mentioned also other viruses, so rhinovirus, also a common cold virus, but there are probably 100 different varieties out there. And then, of course, we have influenza, RSV, parainfluenza, adenovirus, this thing called human metapneumovirus. And what's interesting is we're seeing almost all of these circulating together right now.
And that's the worry, right? People talk about the triple threat of if COVID and influenza and RSV in particular hit a community at the same time, a worry that that could lead to, because of all those factors, more hospitalization, more stress on our health system. How big a concern is that?
Well, I have to go back into the pre-COVID pandemic days, and quite often during December, January, or February, we would get to a point where our hospitals were overrunning with patients. But at this time, or at that time, it was primarily influenza. So I think we're going to still see that type of effect. But on top of that, we might have a raised baseline from coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. We've had a lot more interest in RSV over the last couple of years. And part of that has been driven by the fact that we finally now have some approaches that are effective in preventing it, namely a vaccine for adults, a monoclonal antibody for infants, and a vaccine for pregnant women to provide protection for their infant after he or she is born. And so RSV has gotten a lot more attention over the last 1.5 to 2 years than it has for a lot of time before that.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID and influenza and RSV and other seasonal viruses, some of them on the rise in Wisconsin now. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. If you're wondering about the diseases themselves, the vaccines related to them, efforts to prevent them, how you've made a decision over whether to get which vaccine, when, and how, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tempty, we've got this latest vaccine, this latest COVID booster, more targeted to some of the more recent strains of the virus in circulation. As I mentioned up front, uptake on this particular booster has not been super widespread. What are you seeing out there?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, only a little over 10% of us have received this updated vaccine for the 2023-2024 year. And that's a little bit discouraging. This is a vaccine that has been highly scrutinized, not only here in Wisconsin, in the United States, but across the world, and has turned out to be a very, very safe vaccine. And it is an effective vaccine, particularly in preventing the most serious outcomes, such as dying, being in an intensive care unit, and getting hospitalized. It also has been shown to be very effective in preventing long COVID. And long COVID is something that we all want to avoid. So there's really good reasons to get the vaccine and very few reasons not to.
I wanted to ask, people might wonder, hey, I got the first vaccine series, maybe one booster. Do I really need this new booster? Is there going to be that much of a difference between those older ones and getting that new one now?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, with vaccines, we never quite know how well they work until we're after a season. So when we try and calculate out the what we call vaccine effectiveness, it really is after the fact that we're able to do this. That being said, the people who do by far the best are people who have been vaccinated and subsequently have come down with COVID after being vaccinated and developed something we call a hybrid immunity. And this provides the best protection. Beyond that, what we can do to keep our immunity as honed and as pumped up as we can requires what I think is going to be an annual vaccine. We're not calling it a booster at this point in time because it really is a different vaccine every year based on what's in circulation. But this is the one thing that people can do to really increase their odds of getting through this well. And even if you do get sick, you're not going to get that sick.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Richland Center. Paul, hi.
Hey, thank you very much. I want to tell people I am fully vaccinated with all the COVID, but I caught COVID the first part of November, and it took 2 weeks and 5 days for me to get a negative test in a home test. So, and my symptoms, I had all the typical symptoms, but they were extremely mild. But I can understand now. I've avoided this for 3 years. And I can understand how this can kill people real quickly because I had a, you know, lung congestion and all that kind of stuff. But my question to the doctor is, the only shot that I have not had is my RSV shot. I was told that I need to wait 10 days after my second negative test to get the RSV shot. So I just want to find out if that's accurate. I've checked with my local hospital. I checked with my pharmacy. They're kind of telling me the same thing because I will really want to get that. But I really want to stress that even people that are vaccinated can get this thing. But that's not an excuse not to get vaccinated because it will kill you, I am quite sure. So I will hang up and listen to response.
Thanks. Paul, thanks a lot for that question. Let's start with his question. I hadn't heard about this, a waiting period after you've had COVID before getting the RSV shot.
Well, I sit on the adult RSV vaccine work group for the CDC, as well as the COVID-19 vaccine work group. And this is something that I have never heard of. So I don't think this is quite true. We normally, with vaccines, say that if you're feeling extremely ill, it's a good time to avoid a vaccine because it may make you even more so. But in terms of any specific time after COVID infection, I don't think there's anything to be concerned about, except the health system might want you to stay away during that period of time that you still might be contagious. I think, Paul, you said that you had maybe 10 days or longer until your test became negative. More than likely, you were contagious for 5 to 7 days after that and still had presence of some of the viral material in your nose that was being picked up by the rapid test. But again, when people are actively sick with COVID, RSV, influenza, I don't care what it is, it's a good time to stay away from medical settings where there are congregations of oftentimes highly vulnerable people.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is with us, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. He's talking to us about COVID, flu, and RSV and vaccines related to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you taking steps to stay safe, keep others safe during respiratory virus season? Have you experienced one of those three or others so far this year? Do you still wear a mask in certain circumstances? Do you have questions about the vaccines? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about respiratory virus season with Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, answering your questions about COVID, RSV, influenza, vaccines. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling with his... much of a comment as I am a question. I've been trying for months to get a COVID booster. Finally got it 2 days ago. My primary care provider has not been providing it, and now that they've finally started, it's a 1 week wait to, or excuse me, they have one clinic per month to give the COVID booster. I had to go to a pharmacy to get it, whereas 2 years ago, you couldn't walk a block without seeing somebody who was given COVID boosters. So I'm wondering why there is so little availability, why it's so restricted this time around.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Tempty, strictly anecdotally, early on in this latest COVID vaccine, I'd been hearing a lot of people having trouble getting it, even at the pharmacies that were supposed to get it. More recently, including myself, a lot more next day appointments available. What are you seeing as far as the logistics of the vaccine?
Well, currently, it appears that there is a very good supply out there from the manufacturers. We have two primary vaccines, one from we normally call the Pfizer vaccine, the other we call the Moderna. But they should be in good supply. Part of it depends on health systems and their decisions as to how much vaccine to order, when to order it, and so on. And I'm sorry, Tom, that you got stuck in a situation where you were not able to get vaccinated at an appropriate time. But I think we find a lot of variation across the state and across the country.
Thanks again for that call, Tom. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm a 91-year-old Caucasian woman. I have had all the COVID shots, and I had a quadrivalent flu shot about 10 days ago. And so I'm curious about if I've had especially this quadrivalent flu shot, why do I have to get the RSV? What is that? How is that protecting me that the quadrivalent is not?
Dr. Tempty.
Yeah, Nancy, that's an excellent question. So the quadrivalent influenza vaccine covers four different types and subtypes of influenza. And the RSV vaccine is for a totally different virus and provides protection against this other virus that is not covered by either the COVID vaccine or the influenza vaccine. And at this point in time, the RSV vaccine is not a vaccine that is what we call routinely recommended, but is recommended based on individual shared clinical decision-making. This is one that we recommend that people talk to their doctors about and ask the question whether it's right or not for you. The reason for that is there's not sufficient good evidence right now for its ability to protect against the more serious outcomes such as hospitalization. We do know it protects against lower respiratory tract infections, but we're waiting to get a little bit better clarity on how effective it is for preventing those more significant outcomes, especially in older individuals, say over the age of 75, and people with underlying medical conditions.
That's what I wanted to follow up with, Dr. Tempty. Given that this isn't a across-the-board recommendation kind of vaccine, who should be asking that question to their doctor about, hey, do I need RSV vaccine?
Well, by way of personal disclosure, I'm in the age range that could get the RSV. I know a lot about viruses, and I haven't gotten it as of yet. And the reason being is I don't have any underlying heart or lung disease, no metabolic disease, and so on. But I think really the people that will benefit the most from this vaccine are people with underlying chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, asthma, or any other lung disease, people who have known cardiovascular disease, such as a heart attack or a history of congestive heart failure, and a few other chronic conditions. Those are the ones that are likely to benefit most from this vaccine. And for the rest of us, it's going to be more on whether or not it's a good decision for you. I'll give you one other example. If I'm going to be around infants a lot, there could be a good reason for me to be vaccinated to lower the risk that I spread this to an individual who is at high risk with RSV. And that's typically infants, in their first year of life.
Thanks again for that call, Nancy. Hope that helps. Talk to Dr. Jonathan Tempty with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Want to talk a little bit about influenza, Dr. Tempty. Again, one of my pet peeves when we talk about influenza, it's not what we call stomach flu, right? It's a respiratory ailment. What are we seeing in the still kind of early days of flu season so far as strains and how serious they might be?
Well, excellent question. We're starting to see some activity from the studies that my team does down in the Oregon School District, just south of Madison. We had our first positives come up about two and a half weeks ago in school-aged children. So it's out there. We're seeing some hospitalizations across the state. So far this season, I think there have been about 70 hospitalizations for influenza across the entire state of Wisconsin. That's higher than it was back in 2019 into 20, but it's lower than it was a year ago when we had a really aggressive season. So again, throwing caution to the wind, I would suspect that we're going to see influenza increase over the next 3 to 4 weeks and probably peak out at the end of December or early to mid-January and then come back on down. But that's kind of what we're expecting right now.
We got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, I just got a CT scan. I was the only one in the room with a mask on. We can't even mask up to give cancer patients a CT scan. Unreal, Matt says. I spent a lot of time at a hospital last week for a relative. There were very few masks, staff, patients, visitors, and so on. Thoughts on when and where we might still think about wearing masks these days, Dr. Tempty?
Well, I think any time that one is actively sick. So with a respiratory infection, coughing, sneezing, feeling feverish, it's a good idea if you're going to be out amongst other people to put a mask on. I think in medical settings that universally we are using masking whenever there's a patient. Well, we mask patients when they come in if they have a respiratory infection. And the healthcare team is all masked or even sometimes using what we call respirators when we have people who are sick. On the flip side, I think there's a lot of people in the healthcare profession that spent 3 years in masks, and they're enjoying a little break from that. My suspicion is the season goes on, we'll see more masking. But I'm also concerned as the caller that when we're around high-risk individuals, for example, people getting cancer chemotherapy or radiation therapy, that those are situations where we should do a better job of protecting the people who are most vulnerable out there.
Dr. Tempty, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, and thank you so much, and keep safe out there.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us today about the respiratory viruses out there, COVID, flu, and RSV. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, cats can be hard to understand. Why do they do the things they do? It's not impossible to understand them, though, it turns out. Kate talks to the author of The Hidden Language of Cats. Is there a cat behavior you find puzzling? Email about it now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Adventure movies and novels are packed with hidden treasures, locked away under the sands of Egypt or passed around the world in a deadly web of intrigue. The Lost Ark, the Maltese Falcon, so many more. Add to that list now a collection locked away for years, now resurfaced, a treasure trove of classic video games. As reported by NPR, a video game store in Nebraska closed back in 1998. The owners put their collection into storage. There they sat, hundreds of games for Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, and more, many in mint condition, lost in the mists of time. But they've reemerged. The owners are working with an appraiser who estimates that the 173 most valuable items in the collection could add up to a six-figure treasure. After release of the video of the collection, fans of classic games have been excited about the rare finds, including a well-preserved copy of the 1995 Super Nintendo game Chrono Trigger. If you've got a treasure trove of old console games sitting around, it might be time to give them a closer look. It could be the stuff that dreams are made of. This is Central Time.